Well, this week we lost one of the world's most powerful and vocal anti-apartheid icons.
Amanda! Amanda! Viva ANC! Viva! Viva President Mandela! Viva!
That is Winnie Madikizela Mandela. She was the ex-wife of Nelson Mandela, South Africa's late president. And that clip we just played was of her doing South Africa's freedom cry, Amandla means power. Here to discuss Winnie Mandela's legacy is On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen, who grew up in South Africa. Hi, Fenley.
Hi, Adam.
So who was Winnie Mandela apart from being the spouse of a head of state?
Well, Winnie Madikizela Mandela was a fierce freedom fighter in South Africa. She was, as you know, married to the global icon Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela. She was exiled and imprisoned for fighting for the rights of black South Africans and the release of her then husband Nelson Mandela from prison. Now, when Mandela was in prison, Winnie Madikizela Mandela took over the reins of that fight against the apartheid government. Now, if you don't know what apartheid is, it was a system that the white government used for discrimination and segregation against black South Africans for nearly 50 years.
Yeah, for those who aren't terribly familiar with what was going on in South Africa during the apartheid era, let's hear what Winnie Madikizela Mandela had to say when she was in exile.
And of course, worst of all was being without my children and not having the opportunity to play the role of a parent like all parents in democratic societies.
So when apartheid ended, what role did Winnie Mandela play in the new South Africa?
Well, when apartheid ended in the 1990s, it was a new dawn for all who were oppressed under the apartheid regime. Nelson Mandela came out of prison and became South Africa's first democratically elected black president in 1994. His marriage to Winnie Mandela survived, as you know, 3 decades in prison. But 2 years later, he divorced Winnie Mandela. But Winnie Mandela carried on serving the people of South Africa. She held the position of Member of Parliament till 2018.
Just a quick personal question, Fenley. Growing up in South Africa, how present was all of this in your daily experience?
It was always present in terms of when you went to school. I was the only person, along with my brother, who was of color when we first arrived at the school. So most of the people that I went to school with were Caucasians, as you know, it's known in the U.S. And the surroundings that we stayed in was also very segregated. So it was really part of every aspect of your life.
We're talking about the legacy of South African leader Winnie Mandela with Fenley Foxen. She is a producer on this show, and she grew up in South Africa. And to continue our conversation about Mandela's life, Fenley has invited a guest.
That's right, Adam. Joining us is Thandeka Tutu Klashe, the daughter of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Now, Thandeka graduated from Emory University and lived in Atlanta for 2 decades. And she's the CEO of the Tutu Desk Campaign, which provides portable lap desks to students in sub-Saharan Africa. Well, Thandeka joins us on the line from South Carolina. Dumelang, Thandeka.
Hey, Ahem, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Tell me about your early memories or interactions with Winnie Madikizela Mandela.
I guess we knew her as Aunt Winnie. Because, you know, every adult has to have a pronoun before their name, because you can't just call her Winnie. You know, that's just like you are calling me Mom Thandeka. So clearly you have still have your South African roots deeply embedded in you. But I think one of the things I remember about her was just her beauty and her presence. And a loud laugh. I mean, she had an uproarious laugh that seemed to come from the, you know, deep, deep down in her belly. And she would always hug you when she saw you and met you. She was just a larger-than-life person. I don't know whether, you know, as an adult, you know, kind of looking back now, she seemed larger-than-life, but she's always had this presence in our lives and you know, really in our hearts.
Yeah. You were telling me yesterday about the time you and your father went and had Holy Communion with her. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is the time when she was banished to Brandfort, which is, you know, a few hours out of Bloemfontein in the Free State. Her home was in Soweto, and the apartheid government was, I guess, so afraid of her influence among young people and, people in general, that they thought banishing her would either dim her light or dim her fervor, which it did not do. But anyway, we were in Lesotho. And then my father was Archbishop of he was Bishop of Lesotho. And so Lesotho is not far from, it's a few hours drive from Brandfort. And so we would drive to the house where she'd been banished to. And because she was a banned person, she was not allowed to be in the company of more than one other person who was not a family member. And so my father would take Holy Communion to her. And so we would stand on one side of the fence and she would stand on the other. So we were effectively not on the same property as she was. And so we were in the street and she was in her, you know, in the house where she was banished to. And so we would do Holy Communion over the fence. That was one of my earliest memories, I guess. I was in university by that time, so it's not like I was a baby or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one of the memories that's kind of seared into your brain. And when I was talking to my father earlier, he was saying, "Oh, you still remember that?" And so I said, yeah.
How can you forget, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Now let's go back to those dark days of apartheid. Winnie Madikizela-Mandela headed up the fight for freedom for the oppressed when Nelson Mandela was in prison. What can you tell us and help us understand for our listeners about that time for her to have taken up that leadership?
She was always she was under threat, I would say, I guess, from the South African government at the time. She was harassed by the police. She was imprisoned. She was taken away from her kids. She was kept in solitary confinement for over a year. I think the one thing that I do want people to know is that she may have been the face of all of this, but it was not happening to just one person. It was happening to a lot of South Africans. There are many South African women who have gone through a lot of the same type of this type of life of harassment and imprisonment. They just didn't have the platform, the global platform that Winnie has. And so she is the one who she's kind of the face of it. But she was not the only woman to whom this was happening. There were many women who had their husbands. Nelson Mandela was not the only prisoner on Robben Island. There were several other men also on Robben Island. So it's not to take away anything from her to ensure that people know that this didn't happen to one person. It happened to several people.
Yeah.
It happened to several women. And it was a systematic way of trying to undermine Black families and Black lives by, one, you imprison the fathers, and then you harass and degrade the mothers so that children, grow up in almost in a culture of fear of the government.
Yeah. Well, Mama Tandi, we've run out of time, but thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity talk about, you know, a lady whom we revered, and so sorry that she has gone, but we know that she is they are rejoicing in heaven when she came marching in with her Amandla salute and her big smile.
Yeah, we have been talking about the life of South African anti-apartheid icon Winnie Madikizela Mandela. She died this week at the age of 81. Thanks again to our guests. Tandeka Tutu Klashe is CEO of the Tutu Desk Campaign, which provides portable lap desks to students. She's also the daughter of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and she joined us from South Carolina. We spoke also there with On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen, who grew up in South Africa. Thanks to you both for letting us all listen in on that conversation. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Our next guest proves that it is never too late to follow your dreams. Never. She's literally living proof of this. Georgian Dorothy Steele is 92. She began acting about 5 years ago, and then she landed a feature role in Marvel's Black Panther. My Mercer University colleague and On Second Thought contributor Sonia Green talked with the actress about her dream of a long lifetime role.
Ms. Steele, you started acting at 88 years old. How did you get into the business?
It was very simple, actually. I fell into it. I was working with the Frank Bailey Center with Elaine Jackson, and she used to do the Christmas plays. And she had Mr. Greg Allen come to our rehearsal one day, and he told us that if we were interested in acting, he would let us come in for half price. And so I jumped at the opportunity, and that's how I got started.
So what made you excited about acting at the age of 88?
It was something to do. It was a pastime. It was something to do. I like staying busy.
Well, you obviously been very busy because you landed the role in Black Panther. Talk to me about the audition process. What did you have to do to get the role?
Well, that was kind of, I was iffy. My agent, Cindy Butler, from I Submit Talent, told me about the role, and I said, no, there's no way I'm going to do this because I don't have an accent, and I don't want to do comic strips. And then my grandson informed me that Marvel was not a comic strip, that it was a big business. And so he told me to go ahead and try to prepare for it, and that's what I did. I listened to Mandela every day for hours and hours and hours until I could imitate what he sounded like. So then my son, who is Scott Wardell, he's a cameraman, and he is a stickler, and he made me do it time and time again until he thought I was ready for it. And when I did one, and he said, okay, we're ready to go. And so we sent it to my agent, and she submitted it. And they called her back almost immediately and said, who is that old lady? We want her. And that was the beginning of that. It was very, very exciting. It was an exciting time.
Wow, that's quite a commitment. Well, congratulations. The movie has made $1 billion in the box office.
Yes.
Did you ever think you would live to see such a huge milestone in Black entertainment?
No, not in Black entertainment, no. Especially a comic strip character, you know, like, you've never had a Black hero. And maybe this is why it's such a big, big deal. Because, you know, our little young people, they need something, you know, that they can look up to. And Black Panther is a very good example.
But speaking of movies with Black actors, I mean, you were on a set with some really talented
man.
And well-known Black actors and actresses, Chadwick Boseman, Lupita Nyong'o, Angela Bassett, to name a few, Forrest Whitaker. How was it being on the set with all of these Black actors and actresses? What was it like?
It was like I was their grandmother. Everybody loved Miss Dorothy. Everybody, no matter, you know, like I just got there. Who was I? I was a nothing, a nobody. Nobody ever heard of me. But because of for some reason, they seemed to like me. And everybody, every day, like I say, when I went into makeup, all the young girls that were the warriors, the young women, I'm sorry, they were the warriors that would be there making up. We always had a lively conversation, and they would talk to me about what I did and about my life, and I would talk to them about their careers, and I'll never forget when Forrest Whitaker came. He was there when I came for makeup, and he got out of his chair and came over,
shook my hand and said, I'm Forrest Whitaker. What is your name? That was a moment for me, because he didn't have to do that. And then, like I said, every day, everybody treated me with great respect, and it was a pleasure going to work. It was a pleasure going to work. And I'll never forget the fact that I always had four men that were attached to me when we, because we did the river scene over and over again. And my costume was so bulky, one man had to hold my costume, and one man held my right hand, the other man held my left hand, and one man stepped in front of me so that I wouldn't step in a pothole and ruin the whole set. So that was great. They walked me every day to the rocks and made pillows for me to sit on. And then the young warriors that were near me, when we have a break, they would get their little candy and stuff. And then when they would say, you know, that we would start again, they would hide their goodies under my robes. And that was cute. I had a lot of fun.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Let's hear a little bit of your work on Black Panther.
I wish to bring Claw back here to stand trial.
Wakanda does not need a warrior right now. We need a king.
So that is actress Dorothy Steele, and she recently played in Black Panther, and she is talking with me right now. Dorothy, you definitely, I remember you saying earlier that you did some work. You listened to Nelson Mandela every day to get into character. Did it help with your accent, and were there any other things that you learned about the culture that you had to cultivate in this character?
There were voice coaches on the set with us, and when we had to do our lines, she would always go over them with us again, and that made it very easy to do. It was just comforting to know somebody else was there in case I messed up. No, I didn't learn that much about the culture, I'm sorry to say, except that in my mind, I figured out what the merchant tribal elder must have been like because of her costumes and all of the... She must have been a world traveler in the first place because she brought all these new ideas back and she told the king and he put them in action. That's why we were so advanced as a nation. And then I think that we had a very, very well-rounded educational system. And we excelled in the sciences, and that was apparent by the little sister, all the things that she did.
The character of Shuri.
Yeah, and the train that was going so fast and all that good stuff. To me, it was a scientific marvel, what Wakanda did. And I think that's one of the fascinations of the movie, the fact that as Black people, we had this kind of initiative. That we were years ahead in our development.
Well, in one of your recent interviews, you described the movie as a movement. Explain what you mean by that.
I think that we needed something to look forward to. I think that with this movie, it shows what we can do. And I think that if we understand our roles as women, that we will make a difference in how the rest of the world is run. As you saw in the movie, women were the rulers, actually. They were the warriors. They were the thinkers. And I think that that's what we're going to do now. I think we're going to step up to it. I think that the women of today are going to show the world what's going to be the right way to live. I think the women of today are so far advanced that they will never, never, never be second-rate citizens again. I think that's what I mean by a movement. We're going to start stepping up and taking our rightful place in the world, on the world stage. We're going to be a force that has to be reckoned with, because women are strong. We always have been strong. And now, since we are educated and we have more economic means than we used to have, that we can now be more independent. And so we can step out and do what we think we should do, regardless of what anybody else thinks.
So as someone who has lived in Georgia for many years, how does it feel to know Wakanda was made in Atlanta?
Oh, it feels great. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was great that it was made here in Georgia, which, you know, how can I say? We have many black people here that are going places and are doing things. And I'm just thrilled that the movie was made here in Atlanta, in the Atlanta area.
That's Dorothy Steele, the 92-year-old actress in Black Panther. She spoke with On Second Thought contributor Sonia Green. It's been another long week. We talked about student loan debt, lessons learned from political marches, and honoring MLK's legacy. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and discuss some of the top stories from the past week. Time now for the break room.
It had nothing to do with blackface. Lawrence Dunbar is probably rolling over somewhere because it's not contextually accurate.
Currently, Georgians with qualifying conditions can possess cannabis oil in Georgia, but they have to break federal law to get it here.
Education in Kentucky is right now in limbo, and we want to make sure that our students get everything that they need.
Joining us to discuss those stories and more is Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington. Welcome back, Tanya.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Amber Scott of the nonprofit group Leap Year. Good morning, Amber.
Morning.
Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And with us, Georgia State University Professor Hector Fernandez. How's it going?
Great. Morning, everybody.
Morning, all. So this week we have been honoring Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. Wednesday marked 50 years since his assassination, but his legacy lives on.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
So how are we doing on that dream? A recent Associated Press poll finds that fewer than 1 in 10 African Americans believes that all or most of the goals of the civil rights movement have been achieved. Fewer than 1 in 10 African Americans believes all the goals or most of the goals have been achieved. Now, in contrast, about a third of white Americans believe that those goals have all been achieved. So, Tanya, what do you make of that discrepancy?
When I look at the recent rash of police shootings, it's clear to me that the color of people's skin is still being used as a yardstick for the value of their lives. And so it's very hard for me to say, given that reality, that we have realized the dreams that Dr. King spoke about. I mean, when your life is still vulnerable, that's a basic human right, the right to live. When your life is still vulnerable because of your race, that's, to me, signals that there's a lot of progress still left to be made.
Yeah, and there are a number of empirical measures that we could look at to prove precisely what you said. Sumaya, what do you make of the difference in perception among different groups of people as to where we are vis-a-vis the King dream?
Well, I think it's where they're at in society and what privileges does one group have over the other. Have we made any kind of headways in terms of civil rights? Well, on the surface, it looks like we have in terms of employment. We have employment laws, we have housing laws, et cetera. But when we dig deeper and we look at our school system, when we look at the education, when we look at our jails, and there is a huge disparity there. And then also, you know, it's no longer just black and white in the U.S. It's gotten more complicated. And the newcomers, the immigrants and other people of color in different religious traditions, et cetera, they are benefiting from the civil rights movement that Dr. King started. But again, we are not where we should be as a country. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Many of those deep racial divisions that King spoke about are still very much alive, as evidenced perhaps this week During a Griffin, Georgia town hall meeting, Griffin recently declared April Confederate History Month, and in a public forum, one white former city commissioner spoke in support of Confederate History Month, and in addressing an African-American sitting commissioner, this former elected official used the N-word, not once, not twice, but three times, to describe how the city used to be. Now, Governor Nathan Deal did away with Confederate Memorial Day and Robert E. Lee's birthday as state holidays in 2015, still celebrated locally in a lot of places. Amber, does this incident prove Deal right?
I found, first of all, that video was pretty horrifying, especially since he was a former politician himself, right?
Yeah.
And so talking about that's how some of our leadership are still talking about our community, is pretty horrifying. And as a Black American, of course, I find the concept of, a Confederate History Month or Robert E. Lee Day pretty offensive. And yeah. I think regardless of the rationality, because people create all these rationalities around why it shouldn't be offensive and why, this is okay to be celebrating. But the reality is, if doing something like that is going to create a situation where a large part of the population is feeling intense hatred and danger and like they can't leave the house because people are out here celebrating something that is so hurtful to us. Why would you want to build rationalities around that? It should just be, this is not something as a community we're going to support when it's so hurtful to this large population of our community.
Hector, we got a minute left before we got to take a break, but any quick thoughts on that video from Griffin or the topic of Confederate Memorial Day?
If your notion of the past is that you fail to acknowledge that the Civil War was fought over slavery or that the entire economy of the South was based on the exploitation of one race by another, you should not be allowed to celebrate that twisted understanding of the past, basically.
Let's head up I-75 from Griffin to Atlanta, where rental rates are soaring so high that Atlanta is being compared unfavorably to San Francisco.
But it all boils down to one thing. Rent. It's too damn high.
According to an investigation by 11 Alive, East Atlanta Village is seeing the biggest rent surge in Atlanta. Rates for a one-bedroom zoomed up nearly 11% over the last year. A one-bedroom there will now cost you $1,700. That's for a gentrifying neighborhood. This is to say nothing of neighborhoods that have always been pricey, like Morningside, where the average one-bedroom is what? $3,600. So, panel, who is all up there in Atlanta, while I sit here in Macon, where my mortgage on my beautiful historic house is $700 a month.
Wow. Don't brag.
Let's live down.
Oh, I'm going to brag. No. I will brag. What could or should be done about this, aside from becoming, moving down here and becoming my neighbor in Macon?
Yeah, that's crazy. Firstly, I live in East Atlanta Village, and I didn't even know that it had gone that high.
Yeah.
That's horrible. And, I keep seeing them building more they're building more condos on Memorial now, and I'm just like, who is buying that? I don't understand where these people are coming from.
They have to be coming from outside of Atlanta with salaries that allow them to pay these increasingly rising rents. And the mortgages, we're seeing the same thing on the mortgage side. And if we don't do something, then the people who have made Atlanta what it is will not be able to live in Atlanta. And at first, this was just affecting really poor people. And so there wasn't as much interest in addressing the housing affordability crisis and housing justice issues. Now it's about to affect everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, but a southern city going to do rent control? Hector, is that a reasonable expectation?
Why not? It sounds like a good idea to me. it needs to be stopped at some point. The government has to intervene. Rent control works great in New York City.
Yep. It does.
Well, and we also need to advocate for the creation of more affordable housing. We have people who've been living in these communities for generations who are getting priced out. And so, we need to be advocating our government and nonprofits for creating more affordable housing so that it's not just, little bubbles of super wealthy communities. And it's actually, reflects the city and the population who lives here.
You know, that was a real shocker for me as well when I read that story. And I live in Smyrna, so I Googled what's the rent rates in Smyrna. And it turns out that it's around $1,000 for a two-bedroom apartment in Smyrna. So people move on down to Smyrna.
Indeed.
Or Macon.
So many nice places to live in this country. There really are. Let's talk about another really interesting story. A month after West Virginia teachers went on strike for higher pay, Oklahoma and Kentucky teachers followed suit. Every public school in Kentucky and many schools in Oklahoma were shut down as a result. No teachers, no classes. That big strike, statewide teacher strike in West Virginia, worked. Teachers basically got the contract that they wanted from their state legislators. Here, let's go and look at the situation in Kentucky. Here's Melissa Sheets, who is a grade school teacher in Kentucky, who is striking.
I pray and I hope that our legislatures listen and they fully fund our schools. Kentucky's ranked 47th in per pupil funding. And in order for our students to be successful, they need top dollar. We're not an afterthought. We are not something that you can put at the bottom of the bucket.
So what's remarkable to me about this movement is that it's happening in southern states where teachers' unions, for a variety of reasons, are not nearly as strong as they are in their northern counterparts, generally speaking. This seems really remarkable. Tanya, is this something that you think could spread to even Georgia?
Well, I'm proud that our governor has decided to fully fund K through 12 for the first time in a very long time. And I know
explain to people what you mean by fully fund, though. That's a subjective. Well, yeah.
Fully funding it in terms of the standard amount that has been decided as being sufficient to finance the operation of our K through 12 schools. And so more money will be devoted to that, which will include additional money for teachers' salaries, because I believe when teachers aren't paid well, our students' education is compromised. So I know people are concerned that the schools are closed and so kids aren't being educated, but they're not being educated if the teachers are not being paid a livable wage or paid even enough to provide the education that they need to provide for our students so they can become productive members of society going forward.
And if we don't pay teachers, people are not going to take on that profession. And then what's going to happen to our education system? And if we really want to keep America great, we need to concentrate on education and put that as a priority versus not.
Absolutely.
Adam, one thing, the fact that it's happening in so many southern states has quite a bit to do with right-to-work laws. You know, right-to-work laws did not work well for educators. They, in many cases, prevent the defense of their interest.
Let me just define that for people, because right-to-work is sort of a, I don't think that's a neutral description. I know why you're using it. That's how people have come to term, refer to these laws. But essentially, these are laws that go back to the mid-20th century that, in some cases, prevent people, employees of any given profession or workplace from being required to join the union that is representing their interests. And it has, in effect, prevented teachers' unions in Georgia, among other states, from being a very powerful force. Sorry, go ahead, Hector.
No, that's precisely the point. I think the fact that it's happening in the southern states shows that the lack of unions, you know, at some point it has to show up. Mm-hmm. You know, when people have no resources to defend as a group, sooner or later, they embrace, you know, what is only logical to try to improve their standard of living because, mm-hmm. you know, they haven't received a hike in quite a while. Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us, we are in the break room talking about the week's news with Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington, Amber Scott of the nonprofit Leap Year, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Hector Fernandez, professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. All right, one more education story. An Atlanta charter school got a major backlash for a performance in which students wore masks representing blackface. And I'm not just talking about black faces, but masks representing actual minstrel show style blackface. Both African-American and white students held up the masks while they recited the poem "We Wear a Mask." Here is part of their performance. A teacher who had these students wear blackface while reciting this poem is herself African American, and she says that she was trying to use this costuming to shed light on the, quote, non-pretty aspects of black history. The charter school is apologizing profusely. Amber, do you think that they should be?
So I think that they should be apologizing. I think that this is a really good case of, you know, intentions, again, regardless of your intentions or rationality, this was a big lapse in judgment. The optics were just so bad. It was really offensive to a lot of people and for good reason. And so I think it's a really good lesson for all of us. And regardless of whether or not the conversation is minority led or not, regardless of the intentions behind it, we really have to get as many folks involved and really be thoughtful and reflective on what we're doing when we're talking about race, just to make sure that we're not, you know, having these lapses in judgment. And just the one other quick point I would make, though, is this story did go viral, you know, went all across social media. But a lot of outrage, a lot of people were outraged without actually knowing the full story behind it. So I also, you know, not to kind of justify the actions, but there is, the story is more complex than folks on social media would lead it to believe. And I think it is important to really understand the full context of what's going on before folks kind of pass these stories around on the internet.
And my issue with it is a complete distortion of the poem. That's Langston Hughes's poem talking about why black people are forced to perform in certain ways in a society that doesn't allow them to be their full human selves, because to do so would have threatened this order that relegated them to second-class status. So she didn't understand the poem. And there's a lesson in that. The students could have learned why people feel like they have to wear masks, not minstrel masks, but masks that are imposed by systemic discrimination. So this young lady, God bless her, really needs to read more of Langston Hughes and some other Renaissance writers to understand what they were trying to say and then share that with her students.
And what surprised me is that the school is going to do cultural competency training for their teachers. It's almost like going to the doctor with something wrong with my foot and he gives me a medicine for my heart. So, you know, there's a disconnect there.
And not even medicine.
That's right.
Well, and you know, and this is such a pretty deep and abstract concept, you know, for second graders to be trying to, you know, perform this. I also wonder, you know, I know her intentions were good, but this is also, again, like the students should be at an age where they themselves can understand what it is that they're talking about and performing. And there, and you know, that there was such a disconnect there as well with these second graders who are essentially reciting something that they themselves don't even understand and holding up these masks, and it was just all bad.
I should mention that I think we said a moment ago that the poem was by Langston Hughes. It's actually by Paul Lawrence Dunbar. But it's okay. It's all the more. This is all an example of why we all need to get an edit, right?
Absolutely.
Whenever you're
going to
do anything remotely racially sensitive,
exactly,
always have someone else look at it for you. I have found that out the hard way myself. Yeah, without a doubt. Okay, moving on. Okay, here's a really good, interesting Georgia news story. Republican State Representative Alan Peake from my neck of the woods in Macon is someone who, over the time in his time in the legislature, has really led the push for medical cannabis in Georgia. In 2015, a bill that he wrote became law. It allows people with certain conditions, like seizure disorders, to take and possess small amounts of cannabis oil. That can really, really help them. Federal law prohibits marijuana transport across state lines, and you still can't buy this cannabis oil in Georgia. But Peake personally distributes the oil to people in Georgia who need it, raising the question, how is he getting it? Peake claims, quote, "I don't have any idea how the product gets here in Georgia. Once we have it, we give it to families and citizens for free." Now, I should say, this is Peake's last year in the legislature. He is retiring. What do we make of his legacy in this area, Hector?
Great. I mean, he's actually not responsible for the product crossing the state lines. That's not his doing, so it's perfectly okay. I think it's high time we legalize, you know, the production of cannabis oil within the state. I mean, lots of families need it. I can only endorse him. I think he's done great.
He had a tremendous fissure with Governor Deal over this issue over their time. Governor Deal really, really resistant to any kind of medical cannabis, grudgingly signed this very, very limited measure that did pass. What do we make of the lingering, very, very strong opposition to medical marijuana among a lot of people across parties?
I think some people are afraid that it is going to lead to the full decriminalization of marijuana, even for recreational purposes. So, I mean, we just, within the past 10 years are allowed to purchase alcohol on Sundays and only after 12:30. So, we're in the Bible Belt. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about something that serves a medicinal purpose for children, for people with seizures, for people who are HIV positive, it seems cruel to allow them to use it, but not to access it. And it just doesn't make sense. So we need to look at what other states are doing and follow suit.
Let's try to sneak in one more topic here. Big one. A lot of people in the media biz are talking about Sinclair Broadcasting Group. This is a broadcasting group that owns now more local TV stations than any other company in the country. And those stations' news anchors were required recently to read a script in a promo telling viewers about, quote, the troubling trend of irresponsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country and how it's, quote, extremely dangerous to our democracy. This went viral when the website Deadspin created a montage of anchors from across the country echoing the same lines in one big unanimous chorus. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our
Treasure Valley communities,
the El Paso, Las Cruces communities,
Eastern Iowa communities,
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS4 News produces.
But we are concerned about troubling and irresponsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media.
Now, I'm concerned about bias and false news, too. I think a lot of people are. Sinclair has gotten a lot of backlash for this because it's that whole promo is painted by the fact that this is a company that has in various ways, I think it's fair to say, been in bed with the Trump campaign and then later the Trump administration, made special deals with them for more favorable content, more favorable coverage of the Trump campaign. Should that necessarily cause us to dismiss a relatively uncontroversial message that we need to be careful about sharing messed up fake news? What do you think, Samaya?
Well, I say that. Thank God for public broadcasting when I read this story.
Right answer.
So, you know, thank you. We all need to support public broadcasting. I agree with the Deadspin message that this is extremely dangerous to our democracy. And Sinclair is really, the stations are the ones who are promoting fake news. And it's just very troubling for me.
Hector, last word goes to you.
They should be fine. If they keep growing, antitrust measures should be contemplated.
All right. That's it for the break room today. Thanks to all my guests, Georgia State University Law Professor Tanya Washington, Amber Scott of the nonprofit Leap Year, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Hector Fernandez, professor at Georgia State University. Have a great weekend, everybody.